Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Jessica from Greenlight and we are thrilled to host tonight's event with AL Press presenting his new book, Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. He's going to be talking with E. Tammy Kim, so you are in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to AL, Tammy, and the team at Farrar, Straus, Giroux for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces right now, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. And very importantly, tonight's featured book, Dirty Work, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can shop in person at our bookstore locations, 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. every day of the week, and you can purchase AL's book and many others on site, or order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. I'll drop that by link in the chat in a moment. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Okay, some introductions. Our interviewer tonight is E. Tammy Kim. She's a freelance magazine reporter, a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times, and a co-host of the Time to Say Goodbye podcast. She was previously a workers' rights lawyer and co-edited Punk Ethnography, a book about the politics of contemporary world music. She's going to be speaking with our featured author, A.L. Press. He's an author and journalist based in New York, the recipient of numerous fellowships and awards for writing and journalism. He's the author previously of the books Beautiful Souls and Absolute Convictions. His new book, Dirty Work, is a groundbreaking and urgent report from the front lines of the work that society considers essential but morally compromised. The book has been praised by a number of celebrated writers, including Patrick Radden Keefe, Michael J. Sandel, Corey Robin, and Rebecca Solnit, who calls Dirty Work, quote, a scathing and thoughtful book about labor and principles, or rather about when the former sabotages the latter in the brutal industries that prop up American life. And she adds, ultimately, Dirty Work is a book about human sacrifice and the forces that disguise it. So you're in for something really important tonight. AL is going to start us off with a talk about the book, and then he'll be speaking with Tammy and with all of you. So AL, please take it away.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Greenlight Bookstore, for organizing this event and having me here. Thank you for all the listeners and participants who are here to ask questions. And especially thank you, Tammy. Your writing on everything from Amazon to the Koreas is incisive and urgent and admirable. And I'm so glad that you agreed to talk to me about this book, because I think you have a unique perspective and a lot of insight. So I'm really looking forward to making this a conversation. I'm just going to begin by giving the audience a sense of what this book is. And it's called Dirty Work, but the subtitle contains the phrase essential workers. And I use that phrase and that term a little differently than how most media outlets right now are using it. Of course, it has become a well-known term in the last 18 months because of the pandemic and because of this realization, really, that that as a society, we have a division of labor and we rely on the labor of grocery clerks and delivery drivers and long-haul truckers, all these people who could not or were told they could not stop doing their jobs during the pandemic because society couldn't function without them. Of course, we also learned that a lot of those workers are underpaid, they're exploited, they're exposed to physical injury. And of course, during the pandemic, they were exposed to getting sick and often to dying in disproportionate numbers. In my book, I use essential workers a little differently. I'm talking about another hidden class of workers that society depends on, even more hidden in a way. And I'm talking about workers who do jobs that are morally, that are seen as morally compromised, and yet essential to the prevailing social and political order we have. And what I mean is, you know, the jobs of running the world's largest prison system, both the security job that goes with that and the mental health side of that job, because jails and prisons are society's largest mental health institutions at this point. The job of carrying out targeted assassinations in America's never-ending wars, which continue as we're speaking, but which have faded conveniently from the headlines. The job of working in industrial slaughterhouses, where animals are treated and workers as well, are exposed to brutal conditions, again, that most people never see. And so I set out in the beginning of the book to suggest that that these jobs are also essential. Of course, they're not essential to people who see drone warfare in prisons and the meat system in this country as unjust. They would say, well, what do we have to do with any of these jobs? Why would that have anything to do with us? It's just a couple of, you know, it's just some industries run by some very greedy companies or some very powerful interests that have arranged to, in a sense, coerce us into having these things take place. But I think that's too easy. And so the other term I just want to unpack briefly is dirty work. What do I mean by dirty work? The colloquial expression is that dirty work is just an unpleasant task. Could be anything, you know, working as a bouncer at a rowdy club, or being, you know, on the offensive line in a football game. You hear announcers say they're doing the dirty work of blocking. Dirty work in my book refers to something different and more specific. And I borrow and go back and trace the term to a sociologist named Everett Hughes. And Hughes, though very well known at his time, taught at the University of Chicago, and though very influential, his influences include Irving Goffman and Howard Becker, he's kind of forgotten himself and not very well known. But I came across an essay he wrote, published in 1962, called Good People and Dirty Work. And it was based on a trip that, actually on a visit that Hughes made to post-war Germany, where he taught in the city of Frankfurt. And while there, Hughes reconnected with and spoke to the people he'd known before the war. And the people he'd known were not committed Nazis. They were not, you know, ideological fascists. They were cosmopolitan, liberal-minded people, as he put it in his diary, the kind of people you'd meet in any sort of university setting in the United States, artists, intellectuals, journalists, architects. And he starts asking them, you know, what do you make of what just occurred in this country? Of course, he's referring to the genocide that the Nazis perpetrated of the Jews and other racial minorities. And he's at this architect's house one night, and the architect says to him, well, you know, of course, whenever I hear about this, I'm ashamed for my people, which is exactly what you would expect a cosmopolitan, liberal, good person to say. But then he proceeds to say to Hughes, but you know, the Jews, they really were a problem, and something had to be done about this problem. I'm not saying that what the Nazis did was right, but you know, these people were taking all the good jobs, they were running around in their filthy ghettos and so forth. And Hughes keeps hearing this on the one hand, on the other hand, response from the good people that he meets. And out of this, he formulates a theory, and he argues that, you know, the people who did the dirty work in Nazi Germany were not rogue actors who were just acting at the behest of the Führer, but they were actually agents of society and indeed of many good people who refrained from asking too many questions about what they were doing because at some level they were okay with it. And so you're thinking, well, okay, this is an interesting essay about Nazi Germany. How does it apply to our world? Hughes, being a sociologist, was interested in identifying dynamics that actually play out in every society. And he was quite explicit about the fact that he wrote this essay, not as a sort of contribution to the literature on Nazi Germany, but as a, he addressed it to, as he put it, his fellow North Americans, to put us in mind of the dangers in our own midst. And he meant by that racial violence, police torture, private lynchings. He mentioned all of these things. And this was, you know, early 1960s, the United States. And he said, you know, here too, in a democracy, we have to ask what kind of dirty work has a kind of unconscious mandate from society. We know it's going on, but it's going on in the shadows. We don't want to hear too much about it. And let's just go on with our lives. And I was fascinated by that concept and that idea. And it's really the starting point, the point of departure for the book. You know, 60 years after that essay was published, what kind of dirty work do we tolerate here? And what does it say about the kind of society we have? And I'm just going to say a very little bit about the first dirty worker, the first person doing dirty work that is in the book, a mental health aide named Harriet Kraskowski. And she gets a job at the Dade Correctional Institution, which is a prison in Florida. And as she starts working there, she starts to realize that the prisoners, the patients who are entrusted to her care, are getting mistreated and abused. They're being denied meals. They're being verbally accosted. She goes into work one day and she hears about one particular prisoner named Darren Rainey, who was taken to a shower after he had defecated in his cell. And the guards had told her, oh, well, we did this to clean him up. But the nurses at the prison tell her, no, that's not what happened. They did this to punish Rainey. And Rainey, in fact, was locked inside that shower whose water flow and temperature was controlled by the guards. And the temperature of the water was 180 degrees, which is the temperature of a cup of tea. And he collapsed in the shower. He died. Autopsy photos showed his 90% of his body was covered in burns, all of which was covered up initially. Covered up, I mean, that the official report covered it up and said he had no thermal injuries. Harriet hears about this. She learns that it's not unique to Rainey, that this has been going on for a while. Rainey's just the first prisoner to die there. And she says, as she said to me, she said to herself, you know, someone has to report this. But she does not report it herself. And none of her fellow mental health staffers report it. Why don't they report it? Because they are beholden to the guards in that facility for protection and security themselves. And in fact, earlier, when Harriet had started to question some of the abuse she was seeing, she complained when some of the prisoners weren't allowed into the rec yard, which was their only access to open air. She would go into the rec yard and find herself suddenly alone. The guard who was supposed to be there was gone. And on one of these occasions, she was actually assaulted and threatened and felt, you know, she could well have been, anything could have happened to her. So she got the message, which is the message all these mental health aides receive. Don't defy security in this institution. We run this place. You don't. And so she lives with the knowledge that she's allowing this abuse to go on. And as I say in the book, this is, although it was an extreme case and a truly graphic and horrifying case, it's by no means a unique situation. Because again, we have turned jails and prisons into our largest mental health institutions. We have, in a sense, solved a problem. The problem being that we don't provide adequate mental health services, public services for people in this country. So effectively, you have criminalized both poverty and mental illness, especially the intersection of the two, race, poverty, and mental illness. That sort of combination is vastly overrepresented in our prison system. And what you get is systemic abuse that is dehumanizing, not just, of course, to the prisoners, but also to the staff, putting them in situations where they are making decisions that go against any kind of ethical code for a provider of care. So that's how the book opens. I'll say more maybe as Tammy and I have a conversation together.
Thank you so much for that, Eyal. That was terrific. And thanks again to Greenlight, my neighborhood bookstore, and to FSG for putting this event together. Please, as Jessica suggested, if you are listening in, insert your comments into or questions into the chat and Q&A, and we'll get to as many audience questions as we can. Ayala, maybe we could back up from Harriet even a little bit, and you could talk about how this book came together. Was her reporting on her story sort of the motivation to do it? I certainly see continuities between this book and your previous two books. Your first book, very personal account of your father as an OBGYN who also provided abortion services, being stuck in the abortion wars. Your second book, Beautiful Souls, about people who, under extraordinary pressure and very difficult times, went with their conscience, went against the grain of the sort of moral consensus around them. In that sense, this book is sort of like a mirror image at times of the characters in that book. But yeah, if you could just sort of talk about your kind of reporting journey and how you sort of, you know, how this all coalesced around Hughes's sociology of dirty work.
Sure. There's a clear connection. It's not very well hidden, unlike other things that I discuss in the book. And I guess what I would say is that my last book, Beautiful Souls, was about people who held on to their principles when thrust into these incredibly compromising situations. None of them saintly figures by any stretch. In fact, many of them quite flawed, all flawed. But capable of these sort of extraordinary acts of courage. As I was writing the book and researching the book, I kept coming across people in the context I was writing about who actually had gone along. So I remember very clearly a night I spent in the Balkans where I wrote about someone who had risked really his life to help a different ethnic group in the midst of ethnic cleansing and an ethnic civil war, a deadly civil war. And I was at this bar with all of these guys who had actually done some of the ethnic cleansing. And they were 18, 19 years old at the time. At the point we spoke, they were in their late 30s or 40s. And I could see how broken and haunted they were. It's not like we spoke explicitly about things, but they would sort of refer, you know, obliquely to things that they'd seen done and done, burning, you know, the houses of neighbors of theirs. And on one level, I felt an impulse to judge them because of their culpability. And you can't escape the fact that they did what they did. On the other hand, I felt, how different would I have been in their shoes? So I got kind of hooked on that question repeatedly as I was kind of going through writing about these people. Mm-hmm. And I guess I felt like I wanted to write about the people who do dirty their hands because they're more common. Their stories are in a sense arguably more typical. But I also felt like particularly as I started thinking about America and the United States and who is placed in the positions of being in these kind of dirtying jobs that are stigmatized, that stain you in some fundamental way. How do we organize that work and who are the people who do it? And the more I thought about that, the more it became clear to me that this was actually a book about inequality, because elites find ways not to do these things. I'm not saying by any stretch they don't do things that are morally compromised, but I have a whole analysis in the book of why the experience and the story you can tell yourself if you're a banker, say, who does something morally compromised, is very different than what someone like Harriet can tell herself, and what society also, how society looks at you. So it became a book about kind of, you know, and Hughes himself asked this question, you know, we have to ask, who does it? You know, who are the people who end up doing this? So I went back to that, and kind of this became very much a book about racial divisions, about class divisions, about geographic inequality. All of those things play into how dirty work is organized and who does it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's so interesting that in a way there's a sort of pivot from, you know, kind of moral analysis to almost a kind of labor-based analysis of these characters of this world. I'm wondering, you know, as you talk about class and geographic divisions and the opportunities that people have, and so much of this reporting was obviously done before the pandemic, but inserting our sort of our now kind of common universal parlance around essential work, what moves did you start making as you were working on the book to potentially kind of reframe or, you know, update some of this thinking for our pandemic moment?
Yeah, I think that the pandemic has been, you know, pandemic has been just a national and international calamity, and would that it would end and that there was, that it had never happened. I think though that like most, you know, calamities of the sort, we learn a lot about ourselves during these moments. And so I was really struck. I did most of my reporting before the pandemic began, but I was really, really struck by the sudden conversation about how some workers get to stay at home and shelter in place and work from their computers and distance themselves from risk. And others are immersed in that and face it all the time, because I've frankly been thinking about all of that for a couple of years as I was doing the reporting. Right. You know, I mean, just very viscerally at in the reporting in Florida, Dade happens to be about 40 minutes south of Miami. And I did do some sort of part of the reporting I did in that section of the book was a magazine story. And when you're a magazine, when you're working for a magazine and doing a story, you stay in Miami and you see all of the sort of the hyper rich, the beach scenes, all of that. And 30 minutes away, you just hop on the interstate, you drive down to, you know, the prison and there it is. And of course, it's not in a wealthy area by any stretch. It's in a kind of, you know, very, very poor area, which is not an accident. But just seeing that contrast, I kept seeing it. And so I feel like the pandemic has kind of opened our eyes a little bit, you know, not yours, Tammy, because you're so acutely aware of how these differences are there and class and race and inequality divides us in so many ways. But just as a sort of national conversation, it was like, oh, wow, delivery drivers and grocery clerks have it really hard. Warehouse handlers, wow, they're injuring themselves. But that was all happening before, and they were invisible largely. The people, the workers I write about are, as I said, even more invisible. And I really think that plays a role in perpetuating all of this, there's a very kind of convenient geography and division and moral division of labor in this country that can enable you to, you know, do exactly what sort of Everett Hughes mockingly suggested of these cosmopolitan people. He called them passive Democrats, which is that, you know, they have a very nice sense of their own ethical compass, but at the same time, they don't ever really do anything and they don't ever feel implicated.
Yeah, thank you. I felt very challenged reading your book as a labor reporter, someone who reports a lot on workers' rights, because I think in the sort of labor reporting tradition, there is a tendency to make heroes, sort of unvarnished heroes of workers, because they do so much and their stories are so compelling, but potentially without so much nuance, you know. And I think, you know, as Tamsin Shaw noted in a beautiful review of your book today in the Times, your book is really characterized, and your work generally, your journalism generally, is characterized by a complete rejection of that framework of sort of this binary of good and bad, of angels and demons. And here we just have every single, as she says, gradation of good and bad. You know, everybody is morally compromised in these particular ways. And you know, so I think it's, I think all labor journalists should read this, because I think, you know, you're getting into so much of, you know, what do these workers go through as they're making their own moral decisions? And then on the outside, as we're looking at them, depending on their labor for our meat or for our oil, we are also simultaneously judging them. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about your kind of approach to this analysis, because on the one hand, you know, in this recognition that poor people may have limited choices and may go into industries where that are compromised in these particular ways, you know, you also don't want to strip them of their own volition. I mean, certainly they're thinking through this. They have their own moral responsibility to their systems of, you know, religion or whatever spiritual guidance. So how do you go about that as a reporter? You know, again, you don't want to make an angel of them or a demon of them. You don't want to make them completely socially determined, but you want to acknowledge those social determinants.
You know, I think a lot of what I tried to do in the book is allow the people I meet to speak in their own words. So rather than me judge Harriet and say, oh, she's an accomplice to all of this, I just, you know, let her say, you know, how tortured she was. I should say, by the way, that as the price of her silence, she fell into a depression. She stopped eating. She lost her hair. There were other members of the staff I spoke to who viscerally, some of them cried, just remembered incidents they'd seen of abuse that they turned a blind eye to and didn't say anything about because they felt they needed their jobs. Now, by no means are they or really anyone in the book, you know, blameless. They say themselves, you know, and none of the situations I'm writing about, I do say that the people I'm writing about have more limited choices and opportunities than society's privileged and powerful. I think that's incontestable, in really in every case I look at. But that doesn't mean they don't have choices. I mean, they do have choices. You know, if you take, for example, the slaughterhouse that I look at, the workers there, most of the workers I interviewed were undocumented immigrants from Mexico. And why were they working there? Because it paid $13 an hour. They could do cleaning jobs or work at Chick-fil-A or do other jobs in this area. One of them did work at a university cafeteria, but it paid $9.50 an hour. They wanted that extra money. It meant something to them. Now, at the same time, it was an incredible, it was a demeaning and difficult job in so many other ways. But I just wanted to go back to the kind of judgment side of it. You know, there are organizations that see the mistreatment of animals in the industrial food system as so barbaric that the only thing we should be doing is exposing the workers who do this. And, you know, I cite a video, a website I saw that had a video which suggested, you know, going after these people to criminally prosecute them for the cruelty to the animals. You know, I think that that's wrongheaded in that case. It is, and I think a lot of you know, people who are activists now around food issues see that that there is an equal and related issue connected to the mistreatment of the workers. These are not two separate things. Right. But in a way, that example and the example of prison people who work in the prison system, you know, they are not clean. But whose name are they acting in? And, you know, I think, and it's pretty difficult to argue otherwise, if you live in the state of Florida, you know, Florida at the time I'm writing and all of these events occur, has the third largest prison system in the country. And it spends the second least of any state in the country on mental health services per capita. So what happens? You know, what happens is the warehousing of people with severe mental illnesses in jails and prisons, which is the absolute worst place to put them. And so, you know, the stories sort of, you know, develop a complexity, I think, because it's not such a simple, I don't think the simple judgment of the people working, blanket judgment, I think it's too easy, you know, and I guess I also feel like, you know, when things like the prison system or the drone wars are written about, I think that if we only write about the suffering of people like Darren Rainey, then again, readers, outsiders, can easily just think, okay, well, the blame there rests with the private companies that are privatizing prisons. The blame rests with, you know, the people who passed those terrible mandatory minimum sentences years ago. But certainly blame does rest with those forces. And I describe them in great detail. In fact, the entire mental health ward at Dade was run by a private company, as was the entire healthcare system in Florida's prisons by two private companies. They're certainly culpable. They certainly share blame. But I think if we just, I think getting to the stories of the people kind of on the front lines who are doing this complicates the way that as readers, we sort of connect to all of this. We can't just simply blame it on, you know, a cabal of corporations or a few bad politicians. It's really the society we've structured.
Yeah. I think there's a fear or maybe an anxiety on the left that if we do delve too much into the sort of complexities of these people's lives, that we're somehow kind of condoning or sort of, you know, accepting that these industries will continue into the future. I think in the book, you have, you know, relatively harsh words for, I think, maybe leftists who judge these people quite harshly. I keep thinking about a drone surveillance operator in the book who, you know, sort of has a mea culpa, basically, you know, comes to understand what she's doing, is tormented by what she's doing, and later tries to speak out against warfare of this kind, and isn't accepted by anti-war activists. Could you talk a little bit about that case or that problem more generally of, you know, do we bring these people into the fold? Like, what does it mean to be in community with people who do carry out this kind of suffering?
Well, I think that I want to complicate a little bit just that whole story, because I do talk about the protesters who go to drone bases and try to draw attention to what's happening and stop what's happening. And I have to say, I think on one level, they're tremendously admirable because they're not passive Democrats. They're actually thinking very, very hard about what's being done in their name. And I go to the home of one particular activist and I asked her, you know, how often do you think about you know, these targeted assassinations, these, you know, what are called precision strikes, which kill so many civilians that don't get covered in our news and get no attention. And she said, I think about it every day. And she organizes protests and she tries to go out there. And I depict all of that for a reason, which is this is the opposite of being a passive Democrat, just as it's the opposite for people who, you know, care about migrants and you know, protest what various government agencies, Border Patrol agents and others are doing. So on one level, that's extremely admirable. Mm-hmm. On another level, though, when the sort of stigma and the thrust of the fault and the blame goes on the frontline workers who are in these situations, mm-hmm. I think it's very easy for folks to forget what were the larger circumstances that might have led someone like that drone operator into the drone program. In that particular case, it's the desire to escape from a small town where there were no opportunities and everything seemed really bleak. And this was a way to get an education and to get out of that town. And frankly, that's why a lot of people enlist in the military. And it's not an accident that, as I argue and try to show in the book, we don't have equality of service. We have disproportionate service from less well-off communities. And part of that is a story of class and a story of race. I think that one way people on the left might understand this is to think about Abu Ghraib. And here you had this horrible torture that was exposed. Who was blamed for it? The people blamed were, you know, Lindy England and a couple of other low-ranking reservists who were in those awful photographs flashing the thumbs up sign. And of course, they were culpable, but not a single senior official was held accountable for what happened at Abu Ghraib. I suggest in the book that the inequality isn't just about who does this work. There's also inequality in who ends up taking the fault for it. And the easiest people to blame in prisons, it's always like this. They find the low-ranking entry-level guard. Often in the case of Florida, as I reveal in a couple of cases I describe, the person who actually wasn't involved, but was there and therefore becomes The Fall Guy for what was tolerated by the assistant warden, pushed by some more senior officer, and then also reflective of a system that ultimately goes to Rick Scott, then the governor of Florida, who was in charge of the Department of Corrections and took no responsibility for any of this. So I think if people who are appalled by some of what's in the book think about it in those terms, I think that it will lead to questioning that impulse to just throw these blanket judgments on people, mm-hmm. on the workers.
Do you think that this is a matter of improving working conditions in these industries? I mean, you know, maybe that's a clearer question with regards to, say, slaughterhouses, or, you know, which I think, you know, although, you know, certainly there are people who are against the consumption of meat or treatment of animals in this particular way. You know, there isn't a sort of like abolitionist movement against slaughterhouses in the way there is against the carceral system or policing or, you know, warfare. Yeah, so I've just been, you know, thinking as I was reading, like, what is it that needs to be done from a policy perspective to make it so that these workers are not forced into this kind of decision making? You know, is it the sort of traditional labor solutions? Is it, you know, kind of welfare status, like broad programs? Like, what comes to mind for you?
I think that I have to be honest and say that I'm not a policy expert. And if people are looking for that in a book, there are other places to go that they're gonna be more satisfied. I think if people want to get inside these worlds in a way that we rarely do, frankly, I know as a reporter that if you go through the front doors of a drone base or a prison or a slaughterhouse, you're going to be shown a staged reality, not the reality that people actually see who are in there. And I felt, you know, if I could find people who were working these jobs, it would give you a sense of what it means to do these things. The book is a work of exposure and analysis. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to suggest that instead of seeing all of the people who do America's dirty work as rogue actors who have nothing to do with us, that we see them as our agents, as people who are doing these things that are to a very large extent tacitly condoned and deliberately ignored. I guess the one sort of policy thing I would throw out, there are places in the book where I speak specifically about the role of government and mm-hmm. the slaughterhouse.
Yeah, you do.
Slaughterhouse chapter is probably the most explicit place, right? Because I talk about how, during the pandemic, actually, the Secretary of Labor, Eugene Scalia, had a little history in all of this. He was a corporate lobbyist who helped destroy and scuttle an ergonomics standard that would have and could have really changed conditions in poultry plants and meatpacking plants in this country because of repetitive injuries. The injury rate is really astonishing. And mm-hmm. I didn't speak to a single worker who didn't suffer, you know, in their wrists, their hands, their shoulders. Their bodies were broken, and to no small extent, their spirits were broken. So in that sense, there's a very specific role for government. There's also a very specific role for organized unions to play. The unions in that sector are much weaker than they were. You know, 40, 50 years ago, meatpacking used to pay more than the average factory job, and now it pays less, especially in poultry. So in that sense, you'll see mm-hmm. some of the policy analysis. But in the rest of the book, it's really not there that much. The one intervention I do think I try to make that has a sort of policy aspect to it is that I try to contest the idea that although I've said how secret and covered all of this work is and how out of the way it is, and that's true and it's very real, I think that is also, I'm not sure if it's secrecy or apathy that is the real problem. Because if you think about the drone program, that's the most secretive thing I write about, maybe with the possible exception of slaughterhouses where you often can't bring a camera in. But with the drone program, even if you find people who are in it, they're not going to talk to you about specific missions. And it's so swathed in secrecy. And yet, you can go to your local library and probably find 10 books that have been written about drone strikes and the drone program and innocent civilians who are struck and how many lies have been told about this program through the sort of official precision strike narrative. You can go online and download really vivid and powerful reports that will tell you a lot about what this form of warfare actually is versus how it's been sold. You can even see Hollywood films that raise these questions. So is it really that we don't know about this, or is it that we lack what Everett Hughes called the will to know? Yeah. And that I love that phrase because he really puts it back into, and again, the whole idea of dirty work, in my mind, is that it's a relational dynamic. It doesn't just happen out there. Mm-hmm. It happens within a social system, and its reach and its stain and its contours might be contained in some ways, but they actually extend outward. And that actually has a lot to do with why I chose the cases I chose. Mm-hmm. I can say more if.
Yeah. Do you want to tie up that thought? Because you did make this very strategic choice of these particular industries that we have these intimate relationships to.
The one criteria I chose for each of the cases in the book is that I wanted it to be an activity that isn't marginal to our lives and to this country. So if you think of the consumption of meat in America, cheap meat in particular, and the production and consumption of that, that is not a marginal activity in this country. Right. If you think of, there's a section called Dirty Energy about an offshore oil driller. We burn a quarter of the world's fossil fuels, you know. And so again, this is not marginal to the American way of life. It's very central. There's also a little section at the end about dirty energy and sort of the mining that goes into the digital devices we all hold, where there's a form of dirty work that takes place in the Congo and has been offshored to a large extent, outsourced and placed offshore. But again, it's very central to our lives, these sort of gadgets, these devices. And then if you think about prisons and drones, you know, if you talk to someone outside of this country about America and you get to more critical stuff, the first thing they're going to tell you is, you know, America's a democracy, but you have the world's largest prison system. How do you explain that? And another thing they'll often tell you is, you say, you know, you export freedom to other places, but can you tell me a little more about this? The fact that, you know, you do these targeted assassinations in countries with which you're not at war, an unknown number of them. Who else does that? And how do you have the right to do that? How do you reconcile that with this idea that you're this, you know, shining pillar on a hill? So all of the cases I chose were chosen for that reason. They're not things we can say don't matter. In this country, they're very central to who we are, I think, at this point. And so that's kind of how I chose them.
It makes a lot of sense. And I was obviously thinking a lot about your drone work, given what's been happening this week in Afghanistan. I think this is certainly on all of our minds this week, at least. I wanted to fold in a quick question from Kelly in the audience, who asks how you think the technology and automation of jobs impacts dirty work.
Great question. It's taken up. I take it up in two different places and in somewhat different vein in both places. The first sort of discussion of that question is obviously in the drone section, where I actually say that you know, there was this fear among anti-war groups and human rights organizations that drones would you know, make killing antiseptic, make it clean, if you will, turn it into a Nintendo video game. And I suggest, based on the reporting I did and the people I spoke to, not just the individual drone operators who become deeply troubled by this, but also the military psychologists I spoke to who are seeing incredible rates of burnout and stress within the program. They can't keep enough people. That turns out not to be true. And why isn't it true? I think that there's, you know, something fundamentally disturbing about fighting a war on screens from a distance, watching this violence unfold, knowing that the decisions you make will have life or death consequences for other people, and yet not being in any way threatened oneself. And you will hear military people in the book that I quote saying, you know, when you turn a soldier or a trained fighter into, when you eliminate entirely, 100% the risk on one side, you turn a soldier into an assassin. They literally say it like that. And so much about how war unfolds is about, and the sort of aftermath and the kind of psychic toll that it takes on the people in the war, is about the explanation and the story you can tell yourself afterwards about what happened. So if you think about Vietnam, or you think now about Afghanistan, this is very much the case with Chris Aaron, the first drone operator I write about. Mm-hmm. What led to his disillusionment and distress was actually going to Afghanistan, where he thought all of these high targets had been hit by drones and therefore America was winning, and seeing that, no, that wasn't the case at all, to the contrary. And that doubt that crept in sort of created this, there's a book by Jonathan Shea about, who coined the phrase moral injury. Mm-hmm. And he argues that it begins with betrayal. Betrayal by society and by one's commanders of what your mission actually was. Right. This is in the context of Vietnam, but if you think about it in the context of Afghanistan, it's very similar. So anyway, to get back to the technology question, I don't think technology eliminates the sort of the potentially morally troubling aspects of what people are doing. On the other hand, I think it can, the automation that I speak about later in the book is about things like, you know, high-tech companies, Amazon, Google, and others who are helping to automate, you know, fossil fuel drilling and finding reserves under the ocean. There's an article I came across called Automating the Climate Crisis. There's a former Google worker I interview, Laura Nolan, who quit actually because she found out that a program she was being tasked to participate in was a deal with the Pentagon, and it actually had to do with drones and with improving what the video footage. And she was horrified. Nolan lives in Ireland and just thinks this is unethical. You can't do this. And there, I think that as she herself told me, she wasn't the person who was going to be, you know, watching the bombs hit. Right. She was really removed from it. And as she described it, and as I think others described it for me, tech workers, you know, very rarely, it's so segmented and there are so many layers mm-hmm. of distance that you can very easily compartmentalize. And I think in that sense, technology does play a very direct role in kind of removing people from thinking about the consequences of their actions. Mm.
Speaking of big tech, Susan in the audience has a question with regards to basically American style capitalism and the sort of priorities of this country, which tend to be very, you know, sort of corporatized, business oriented. I mean, given the what she calls a cost benefit analysis mindset of this country, how do you think the U.S. can deal with the inequities that are highlighted in your book?
So I think it came across. I'm very grateful for that review you mentioned. And one of the things I'm most grateful about is that it ended by noting that this is not a despairing book. It's very visceral about the ugly things that are going on. But it's not, I don't say, and I don't believe that the dirty work I'm describing is immutable, that it's some sort of structural reality that can never change. And in fact, in all of the particular examples I'm looking at, a lot has changed. So mass incarceration was not even on the map as a negative thing in this country politically 15 years ago. You know, it took Michelle Alexander, it took organizing and activists and public conversation for years to just get us to the point to realize, my God, look at what this has done. Look at what it's done to African-Americans and communities of color. Look at what it's done to poor people. Look at what it's done to people, the mentally ill. We're still not fully, I think there's a great deal that's left, including looking at the conditions of incarceration, which I think are still largely ignored and out of the conversation, but a lot has changed. Mm-hmm. And then if you think about inequality was not on the map. I mean, when I started out in journalism in the 90s, this was the neoliberal, you know, summit, and America was the model for the rest of the world. Europe had to get with it and be more like us. It took Occupy Wall Street. It took, you know, an enormous amount of time and energy and work to get conversations going about, to get the phrase, mm-hmm. the 1%, the 99%, you know, to have people sort of state what is staring us, had been staring us in the face for years. So in that sense, I think there's a lot that can change, and none of this is sort of etched in stone. I think with inequality, the contribution I'm trying to make is to suggest that it doesn't always take material form. So we have a conversation about inequality of wealth, inequality of wages. We don't have a conversation about inequality of stigma, inequality of, you know, morally degrading and defiling jobs that will destroy your dignity or lead you to suicide or lead you to hypertension and divorce and alcoholism. All of the things that show up in the book. You know, those things are really hard to measure. They're really hard to capture. They're so sort of privately held in so many places that they get sort of washed out. But I think if you think about what actually lends meaning and dignity to people's lives, those things are really crucial. That's the contribution I'm trying to make. I'm suggesting that there isn't just economic inequality, there's moral inequality. And there's a sort of conversation we should be having about how we have organized the most, you know, troubling industries and activities in our society so that they're out of the way of the elites. The elites don't have to do them. They don't have to see it. And they don't have to feel implicated in it.
Yeah. Thank you. I invite the audience to continue asking questions. We probably have time for a couple of more, but while we're waiting, I will throw in one more of my own, which is, Eyal, I'm curious, I think, you know, in the discussion of sort of dirty work, you know, bringing up kind of war and prison work seems, natural isn't quite the right word, but seems more, I guess, like, well accepted maybe than sort of like ecologically dirty work. But in your book, you set them up sort of on an equal plane, which I think is fascinating because, you know, the chapters, we have the prison nurse, we have the drone operators, and then, you know, and then the ecological questions kind of come up around tech, around oil, around the slaughterhouses. And I think in this day and age, given where we are with accelerated global warming, obviously, and for young people in particular, this is very much of our minds of this is what is dirty. This is what is the most sort of morally compromised thing because this is the thing that is the most existentially threatening to us. Can you talk about folding in that sort of ecological analysis or, you know, kind of putting that sort of, I guess, environmental violence against the human violence?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so in I try to define dirty work, as I say in the beginning of the book, that it's work that causes substantial social harm, either to people or to non-human animals in the environment. I'm not making a judgment about whether those things are equal. I have my own views about that, but I don't think at this point that we can ignore those kinds of harms. And that's a good thing, you know? I mean, we're too late. We're too inadequate on so many levels. And actually I was thinking, you know, I was scrambling as I was sort of trying to close the book and the administration was shifting. What was I going to say about something like, there's a section about energy and oil drilling and fracking and all of that. What was I gonna say, given that I'm not able, I didn't have a crystal ball. I didn't know what the Biden administration would do. And before I closed the book, you know, Biden actually said climate change is a national security priority. So here was this, you know, big change. People like Bill McKibben were very encouraged. Yeah. Last week, I believe, the Biden administration was pressuring OPEC to increase production. They don't want prices of oil to rise. That is what you know, Adam Tooze, the historian, called that's middle-class foreign policy. You know, serve middle-class consumers in the short term because they're important and they're voters and we need their support, and to hell with the environment. Yeah, we care about the climate, but when it ultimately comes down to it, we really care that people don't have to pay more at the pump. And, you know, I think that there is in the book a sort of a real critique of kind of politics that starts and ends with consumer choice, and certainly with politics that's practiced by the Biden administration that is designed solely for consumer interests.
Yeah, very striking example. Thank you. I think we have time for one last question. This is from Anonymous. Could you expand on your idea of moral inequality as it relates to actors and agents and complicit people in relationship to one another?
Sure. So, you know, I think that the sort of premise of the book is that we have a society that has turned things like stigma, shame, and guilt, and corroded dignity in the workplace and in these environments that has made it more likely for some people to suffer those things and experience them and live with them than others. Just to take the example of stigma, I talk at one point in the book about after the 2008 financial crash, there was a lot of talk about how bankers were going to be stigmatized, you know, because they were responsible for this. And, you know, there were articles about, you know, who needs Wall Street in mainstream glossy papers. Wow, what a terrible thing it must have been to feel like as a banker at that moment. But I go back to a classic text about stigma, actually written by Irving Goffman, who was influenced by Everett Hughes. It's a wonderful little book. It's very short. It's called Stigma, Notes on the Management of a Spoiled Identity. And one of the things that Goffman says about having a spoiled identity is that it reduces your life chances, right? You basically become not a whole person in society. You are seen as lesser. How many bankers were actually live with a spoiled identity in this country? I would argue very few. And as evidence of that, when the government started regulating, or at least proposing to regulate Wall Street afterwards, there was not this sort of, oh, we're so ashamed, we can't show our faces. There was indignation. You know, how dare you tell us how to do what we do? We do the most important remunerated jobs there are. And I think that stigma is fundamentally mediated by power. So if you have money, if you have, you know, the kind of wealth and accrue the kind of influence and success that bankers do, it's very easy to manage stigma as opposed to being a slaughterhouse worker, to being an undocumented immigrant who's put through the degrading conditions I describe in that chapter. So that's kind of an example of moral inequality as I see it.
Yeah, I thought that was very helpful. Thank you so much for that. I unfortunately think we're out of time, but I want to thank the audience for their incredible questions, for the generosity of Greenlight and FSG in setting this up. Please do purchase AL's new book and his previous two books, but this one in particular, it's really fantastic. Like I said, it was very challenging and touching to me. I think you'll really enjoy how elegantly it's put together as well. We haven't even gotten into matters of style, but it's excellent that way as well. Thank you, AL, and we'll turn it back over to Jessica at Greenlight.
I just wanted to say thanks once again to Tammy and to AL. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation. And thanks to everyone for joining us tonight. Thank you both so much and have a great evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro.fm, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.